Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Leslie G. from San Diego.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Leslie.
Hey, Dave. My friend Dave's back there. I haven't seen him in a long time. Anyway, thank you, Lori, for asking me to speak tonight, and welcome to all our newcomers and the almost newcomer. Welcome. Everybody's welcome here, and happy birthday to Francis and our guy in the back. 27 years. That's awesome. I'd like to start, I guess I'm from New York, and I grew up pretty much the most normal upbringing you can have, you know. I went to school, I was pretty carefree when I was little, you know, and I have this picture that my sponsor had me hang on my wall next to my bed of when I was like 4 years old, and I have this little puppy on my lap, and I'm just smiling, and I'm so happy and carefree, and somewhere along the way, that little girl just got slammed, and I don't know what happened to her, but I was really cute, you know, and I was really funny, and I loved to dance and all that stuff, and then when I was in third grade, I had to get glasses, and I felt really insecure all of a sudden that I had to wear these glasses, and by the time I was in sixth grade, I had gotten more and more insecure, and you know, my mom was really a kind woman. She told me she loved me. She bought me good clothes. She put smiley faces on my lunch bags and all that. And, you know, my parents got divorced when I was nine, like everybody's parents in the 70s and 80s. And so she was a single parent. And, you know, I never really had that good fear of my mom the way a lot of kids do. You know, like if she threatened me to ground me or whatever, I wouldn't pay attention to her. And I was talking to somebody the other day, one of my clients, and she was talking about her niece and how she's this out-of-control, vain teenager, and she just, like, thinks about fashion all the time and all this and what she looks like. And I was like, oh, that's nothing. Let me tell you about what I was like when I was a teenager. This is one of my clients. I don't know what, well, she's a friend of mine from the program, so she knows, but by the time I got to being a teenager, I had started drinking when I was 12, and that was about eighth grade, and I started doing the whole thing where I steal my parents' liquor, replace it with water, which really screws you in the end anyway, because then you're just diluting your own liquor supply because your parents don't really drink it. So, you know, and it gave me that confidence, you know, because I was always the kid that other people bullied. And I was the kid with the kick me sign on her back and who got left out of all the games at recess and never had a boyfriend and all that stuff. And that was really tough, you know, like I had no friends at that time. And so once I, you know, took this drink, when I was in eighth grade, I somehow managed to, like, get the nerve up to chase the neighbor boy around the house and, you know, try to catch him. And I lost my first friend as a direct result of my drinking because we were on the track team together. It was, like, the one and only year that I joined a sport because I was not competitive. But I did track and I did soccer that year. And had my mom and I stayed in that school district, I kind of wonder if my life would have been different because I was joining things. And I met people who spoke up for me. And anyway, that one friend that I had, she was my best friend. She saw that I was drinking and she said, you know what, I don't want to hang out with you anymore. And I just like totally let her go, you know, like it was nothing. Like all of a sudden this drink was more important than that friendship. And after that eighth grade school year, we moved to a new school. And again, I could be anybody who I wanted. And I just started, you know, hanging out outside the school. And that's where all the burnouts and the, you know, druggies hung out. And they were really welcoming, you know. They were like, hey, yeah, you want to have some pot or whatever, you know. And everybody's very nice. They were very giving and sharing. And it was fine if I drank during school hours. And, you know, so I started just, like, drinking during school hours and getting high with these new friends of mine. And, you know, chasing boys. And... you know, my mom didn't really know what to do with me. My daddy was just like a weekend dad. And if he noticed anything in me, he would just tell my mom that she was being a horrible parent, you know. And really, she was just doing the best she could. But at the time, you know, when you're little, you always have that way of blaming your parents for everything. Well, you know, if I hadn't been a latchkey kid, then I probably wouldn't have been drinking while you were at work and all that stuff. And, you know, but she really just, she was doing the best she could. And later, I researched where my mom grew up, and we went back to where she grew up, which is she grew up on an Indian reservation in Northern California on Hoopa. And, you know, up there, everybody lived in, like, these track homes or shacks, and she had, like, an outhouse for plumbing. She didn't get electricity until she was, like, a teenager. And her parents were alcoholics, and her dad was a huge gambler and would gamble away all the, you know, the money in the family. And her brothers all became alcoholics. And she was the only girl. No, actually, she wasn't the only. She had a sister who committed suicide based from this disease as well. And, you know, after I saw that, I was like, holy cow, I can't believe she did as well as she did raising me, you know. Somehow she's the exact opposite of an addict or an alcoholic. You know, she can have like one cigarette at night while she's watching TV. And, you know, she has continuous pain all the time. So she's on narcotics and she takes it as prescribed all the time. It's so weird to me. But she never mixes it with alcohol or anything. And that's just such a foreign mindset to me. And in ninth grade, I also started smoking. And I remember this one guy saying to me, you know, that's really bad. You're going to end up being an addict, you know, cigarettes. And I was like, no, I can quit any time. And I just want you to know, this past Wednesday was 3 years nicotine free. So it only took me until like 22 years of sobriety to do that. Somebody had said, don't try to quit cigarettes in your first 5 years because it's horrible. And it was, but it's a real miracle today. Anyway, so, you know, that's the situation my mom grew up in. And she made a life for herself where she was successful in her own right. She didn't need a man to take care of her. And she left all her tragedy behind her, you know. And I was just out of control. I wasn't scholarly. I wasn't athletic. I didn't really have any talents that I thought of, you know? Or if I did have any, I was too afraid to use them. And so I always wanted to take the easier, softer way, which was to hang out with these druggies and, you know, get all philosophical when we're drunk and high, you know, because that was fun. So I did fall in love once when I was a teenager, my first love. And for a while, that kept me, you know, kind of straight. And then he cheated on me, so there was that. And then, so I went from him, this really nice guy, who cheated on me, but he was still a nice guy. He was a pretty normal guy, to a homeless heroin addict who got all my friends addicted to cocaine. And so there would be weekends where I would just not come home and I would be sleeping in a park with this guy, you know, or we'd be couch surfing at somebody else's house. And he was like 21 years old and I was 17, which isn't a huge age difference. But when you're 17 and you're hanging out with a 21-year-old who's homeless and on heroin, you know, your parents are going to worry a little bit. And so when I came home at the end of the summer and I was pregnant, my mom was really pissed. And he came by to drop off the money so that I could take care of this little situation. And my mom ended up kicking him down the stairs. So even though my mom's like this tall and she's like, you know, 85 pounds soaking wet, like she still kicked this huge 6-foot guy down the stairs because she was pissed. And, you know, and I just kind of went about my life after that. That, you know, anything that happened that should have been processed just got stuffed. It was all about stuffing my feelings and becoming who you wanted me to be. I was a chameleon, you know? Like, I hung out with the deadheads, and I hung out with the metalheads, and I hung out with the preppies, and I wanted to be able to hang out with anybody. I'm going to find my niche somehow. And, you know, kind of like what Miranda was saying about, you know, getting that hole filled from any of you. You know, I didn't know how to have self-esteem, so I sought to have other esteem. I sought to have your esteem. Your esteem was the only thing that mattered, what you thought of me. And if you didn't think much of me, then, you know, I'm automatically down on the ground. I'm nothing. And I was never taught to separate my behavior from who I was as a person. You know, I always thought, well, all these things just make me a bad person. I'm a terrible person. I'm a terrible daughter. I'm a terrible student. I'm a terrible athlete. Whatever it was, I was a horrible person. That's what I felt about myself. And I put myself down every day. And when I got to college, I had always wanted to be a veterinarian. I've been a huge animal lover my whole life. And I always wanted to be a vet. And I remember my dad said to me when I was a senior in high school, he's like, there's no way that you are ever going to be able to get into veterinary school. Because veterinary school is even harder to get into than medical school. And I just like bought it. You know, I wasn't one of those people who were like, oh yeah, I'm going to totally show you how wrong you are. I was just like, he's probably right. You know, because anything bad you told me, I'm gonna take that to heart because you're probably right. Because that's what I thought. So I ended up going to this little college in upstate New York, and it had previously, the year before, changed from an all-women's college to a co-ed campus. So there was like 8 girls to every guy on campus. So even if you were even moderately tiny bit good-looking, man, you got a lot of chicks that year. And I started having panic attacks on campus, and I didn't know what to do. Like, I thought I was dying when I would have these panic attacks. And so, since I didn't have any tools to deal with this, and, you know, back in the 80s, it wasn't like you used medication much. Or I guess people did, but it wasn't a thing. Like, now it's more talked about, and, oh, you have depression, anxiety, here, have some Prozac or whatever. So I would try to seek out something to make me feel better. And usually that was a guy and some booze and some drugs. And so by the end of that year, I was like, well, college isn't for me. I'm just going to go to work, you know, because I needed to work to, you know, keep up my drinking. And I felt that I was like a really functional person, you know, but, and so I had like these lines, you know. It's like Miranda was talking about too. Like, I would never do this or this, you know. If I don't drink in the morning before I go to work, then I'm not an alcoholic, you know. And so I would wait until lunch, drive home, drink at home, and then go back to work so I wasn't drinking at the office. You know, it didn't count. And, you know, and I remember I did go to another university for one semester, and I had this roommate, and we used to go to this bar called Michael's in Pleasantville. And we somehow managed to talk this guy into letting us use his tab all the time, which was a huge mistake for him. But, you know, so anytime I felt bad, I would just go up to Michael's and be like, yeah, put it on so-and-so's tab. And he's so memorable, I can't remember his name. I feel kind of bad about that because I probably owe that guy an amends. And I remember they had a bikini contest this one night, and you could drink for free all night, and the first prize was like $500, and second prize was like $350, you know, and back in like 1990, that was a huge sum for me, so I was like, all right, I'm going to do it, you know, but of course, I had to drink a lot before I was going to get up on that bar, you know, And so I had like 3 shots of tequila and 6 beers and I think something else. And, you know, and I had like 1 contact because I didn't have another pair of contacts. So I had just 1 and I wasn't going to go up there in my glasses, right? And I'm like teetering on the bar, like, yeah, get me. I didn't fall though, thankfully. And until later. And some guy picked me up off the bathroom floor and drove me home. And you know, I was not a blackout drinker. So I don't know if that's a blessing or a gift for me when it comes to, like, having to make amends to people. Because I remember all the shit that I did. And, you know, a lot of people who are blackout drinkers don't. But I remember going home with that guy. And he was a friend of mine from the college. Nothing more. And I just like stripped down right in front of him and got into bed and, you know, I was throwing up over the side of my bed and, you know, and oh, it's just, ugh. Yeah. So having to like think about that, like, but that was normal for me. And I thought that everybody in college was like that, you know? And I still showed up to my job because I also had a full-time job while I was going to college and I was an office manager. So I thought, well, I'm really important, right? Because I have this white-collar job and everything. And when I was 19, one of my best girlfriends, who wasn't really a friend because she was horrible to me, but I grew up with her and her family. Her sister died, her little sister, got hit by a train. And I was so traumatized by that that I decided that I was going to move upstate New York to live with my dad, who I'd never lived with since I was like a little kid. And I was going to quit drinking and doing all the drugs and stuff. Because, well, the drugs were my problem, not the drinking, just the drugs. And so I moved upstate and I moved in with my dad. And the thing about living in the middle of the country, up, you know, upstate New York, is that there is nothing else to do but drink. And there's bars everywhere. And so I made some, you know, fair weather friends for the bars, and I got a job. Well, I had several jobs, but my longest job was I was an air traffic controller and office manager for the local airport. That's the one that I would drive home to drink and then come back to the office. Yeah. Somehow I managed. It was just like one of those really tiny airports. It's not like, you know, there's like maybe 5 planes a day or something. So I didn't make anybody crash, thank God. But, you know, I was at that point, I knew that there was a problem. I knew that I had a problem with my drinking, but sort of. Like, I didn't think that you know, other people don't think that if they go home for lunch to drink, then it's not an issue. Like, they just don't do that, you know? All these thoughts that I was having and these lines that I was crossing, I drank and drove all the time. And thank God I never, you know, killed anybody or myself. And I'm just so grateful for that because there was hundreds of times where that could have all gone bad for me. But I tell this one story all the time. I don't know why. There's a lot of things that I don't remember, even though I wasn't a blackout drinker. I just have always had a bad memory since I was a child. And, like, there's, like, whole relationships that I've had that I don't remember, you know? But this one girl, Lori, who used to meet me at the bar at happy hour, she looked at me this one day after I'd gotten a beer in my hand, and she said, you know, I've never seen somebody physically relax as much as you do the minute they have a drink in their hand. And, you know, and it took me a long time to realize that that was one of my first little ominous warnings, you know, that they talk about in the book. And because she wasn't like that. She was a total normie, you know. And most of my friends were. Because to me, if I wasn't hanging out with those alcoholics, like the town drunk who would come into the bar, and if you let him roll him up in the rug by the door and you bought him a beer, he'll do that. He will let you humiliate him to, you know, get a drink. I was like, well, that guy's a drunk, not me, you know. And I could never seem to have any successful relationships with men, well, or with anybody really, but I was really a control freak about my drinking at this point. Like, the minute I finished a beer or a bottle of wine, it went into the recycle bin in the back porch so that if anybody came over, they wouldn't see any of my empties lying around, you know, because I wanted everything to look normal on the outside. Nobody ever visited me, though, so I don't know why I was a freak about that. I mean, most of the time I was, like, sitting at home watching, you know, Beverly Hills 90210 or Melrose Place and crying and, you know, drunk dialing people or stalking my current boyfriend or, you know. We didn't have Star 69 or caller ID back then, so you could call as many times as you wanted and they wouldn't know that you called them 150 times that day. Or I'd stalk them at the bars, you know, make sure they weren't cheating on me. You know, I had no trust. I had no trust of anybody, and usually I did pick men who cheated on me because I thought that's what I deserved, you know, sort of in the back of my mind, you know. I would get mad about it, but I kept picking that same person over and over again, and I didn't ever let anybody see me vulnerable. Nobody ever got let into who I really am because I didn't know who I was. I didn't know who I was, and so in 1994, I had decided that I'd come to the conclusion I'm an alcoholic. And I remember calling my mom up, and I said, you know, I think I have a drinking problem. And she's like, well, I think you're just a compulsive drinker. Like, that's different? I don't know. And I was like, okay, that's good. That's good. That's better than alcoholic, right? And meanwhile, I was doing some pretty horrible things at work. I was borrowing from the till, you know, so I go to the bar or pay my bills. And since I was the one who, you know, wrote all the checks and nobody had to check me on that, I would just put my bills through the system and pay them right out of their account. And I never kept track of that until I decided that I was going to leave. And so I'm training the new girl before I leave New York to go jaunting off to California, and she accidentally puts my cable bill through the accounting system in a way that our, you know, accountant in Connecticut immediately saw and was like, why is your cable bill in our system? And so I knew the jig was up any minute, so I had to, like, burn everything that I could find, and, you know, I didn't add it up or anything. I just knew I had to get the hell out of New York, you know? And so I just sold everything that I could. And, you know, people up there, they even bought the liquor out of my cabinets and the, you know, half-used food and stuff. It was really interesting to have this moving sale. But, you know, I just, like, sold everything I could, and if it didn't fit in the car, it didn't come with me. And I just took off, and I came here to San Diego, where my other alcoholic brother lives. And I moved in with him, and I told him what was going on, because he was really the black sheep of the family, not me. So I knew he'd know what to do, because he was more of a criminal than me. And it was going to be okay. So I ended up, like, the first couple months, I ended up going to San Francisco to be a nanny for my brother and his three kids and his wife. And I ended up telling my sister-in-law what had happened with work one night when I was really drunk. You know, she was bitching about her, you know, yuppie husband and whatever. And I was like, you think you got problems? Let me tell you. And I just, like, vomited all over her all of this stuff that I'd done. And she's, like, really, really normal. You know, like, by the book, she will always be honest. And so she, next day, took it upon herself to call a lawyer for me. And she told him all about it. And then she's like, yeah, you're going to have to deal with this. And I was terrified. I was terrified to go to jail. And so right after that, I decided to go to my first meeting, which was a meeting in Pacific Beach in July of 1994. Across from where the Vons is now. And I don't remember anything about that meeting other than they gave me a book of meetings and they said, go to this PB Young People's meeting tomorrow night. And so I did that. I went to that meeting and everybody, of course, was like giving me their phone number. And I'm like, yeah, I'm never going to call any of you people. So I don't understand why you're giving me your phone number, because why do you want to hear from me anyway? And then this one girl came up to me, and she got my phone number, and she bought me my first big book. And she called me every single day, and she dragged me to meetings. And I remember, so Saturday we go to another meeting, and then afterwards everybody would go to, you know, someplace in PB where we'd hang out and play chess and drink coffee all night long, you know. And, you know, after a while in sobriety, we'd get whole posses of us and go out dancing in PB or downtown, and it was really fun. And I had really given up the thought that anything would be fun in sobriety, because what the hell do sober people do? You know, I really had no idea. I had no idea. And it turned out that I started having more fun than I ever thought that I could have. And we were going to volleyball on Sunday and having these, you know, meetings on the beach, and we'd all go to breakfast or whatever. And next thing you know, like, somebody in the program's helping me get a job, you know, and I was telling people about me. I was telling them all these secrets that I swore that I was never going to tell anybody. And it was okay. Like, they didn't look at me like, oh my God, you're a hussy, or, you know, that's lightly what it was. They said, it's okay, you know, we're gonna work through this. And so I started working with that lawyer about what I'd done in New York, and I declared bankruptcy. And my family came up with like $1,000 to start with for a first payment. And I worked three jobs my first 2 years of sobriety, and I paid them, I think it was $500 a month until it was paid off. And I'm really glad now that that happened. You know, that was like the most terrifying thing to me at the time. But I'm glad that I ended up accidentally telling my sister-in-law what was going on. Because if I had to wait until I was in my step nine to, like, come forward and, like, admit this crime that I did, and they had no idea, like, I would have been absolutely terrified. But I managed to make that amends, like, right at the beginning of my sobriety. And, you know, by the time I was two, it was done. And anyway, so I got a sponsor right away. And then she ended up leaving town, so I got another sponsor. And my second sponsor, she took me through the steps, and she would read the book with me. And that was really important, because I had a really hard time concentrating, because I was, like, drinking, like, six Cokes a day and having like three cups of coffee at every meeting I went to, and I'd be like, I can't sleep, I don't know what's wrong with me, you know. And she's like, all right, maybe lay off the caffeine a little. And because I didn't know what else to do. I had no job in the beginning, so I would just go to meetings and hang out at the beach with sober people all day. And that was, I was really glad for that. I was blessed with a pink cloud. I know a lot of people don't get that, and I'm glad that I didn't have to relapse. I did have two beers on my 28th day, so my sobriety date is August 12th, 1994. But I called somebody right after the second beer, and later I was like, God, you're so stupid, you should have at least tied a good one on before you called somebody, right? I would have had sponsees, you know, that when they'd relapse, they'd like, they would call me after they were in the hospital, and I was like, good job, you know. anyway, so I got through all of the steps, and I had my first spiritual experience. And I didn't know how to have a personal relationship with God, but I was willing. The door was open, and I was thinking about it, and I started reading all these spiritual books, and you know, asking other people what they use for their higher power, you know. And I'd always been Christian, but not really Christian, you know. Just go to church sometimes, and, you know, I believed that he was there somewhere, but not for me, really, you know. I never thought about having a personal connection with a higher power. I didn't know how you do that. And so, you know, my spiritual experience was of the educational variety. And when I was a year sober, I had lost my job. Well, it was a year and a half sober. First, a year sober, I had this new sponsor, and she used to make us go to La Jolla Speakers, and we all had to sit in a row with her, and she'd have like mandatory meetings, and, you know, she was like one of those a Nazi big book thumpers, right? And so I was still making some good bad decisions, you know, even at a year sober. So there was this really hot client that I had from my work who lived in Arizona, and he asked me out, but he lived in Arizona. So I invited him to come to San Diego for the weekend, and he proceeded to offer all my friends cocaine in the bathroom at the club that we went to, and he got really drunk, and then in the morning he sexually assaulted me. And this was like the first time where I had been sexually assaulted before when I was drinking, but I thought it was all my fault because I was drunk, you know? So I never thought of it as something that I could be upset about because I brought it on myself because I was drinking, right? And but when this happened, I absolutely did not want it. And I said so vigorously, you know? And he finally stopped after I started crying, and he left. And, of course, I didn't want my boss to find out at this time. And, you know, he's a really nice guy, and I really liked him. He was like a gruff kind of father figure. And I thought for sure if he found out that I was, you know, invited one of the customers to my house for the weekend, that I'm going to lose my job. And he ended up finding out from his daughter, who found out from me, and he came down to the warehouse where I was working, and he said, I just want you to know we're never doing business with that man ever again. And he put his arms around me, and I just started sobbing, you know, because I couldn't believe that here's somebody who's not in the program and is my boss, and he's willing to do that, you know. And my sponsor, on the other hand, she fired me because I would not report the assault. And for a long time, I was really mad about that. But I realized that she was working with what she had, the information that she had, you know. And over the years, I ended up educating myself a lot about sexual assault. And I became a sexual assault advocate here in San Diego for the Center for Community Solutions. And, you know, I really, really learned what that meant and how to help other women who've gone through that. And so, once again, something that was real traumatic for me turned into a gift that I was able to pass on to help other people. And, you know, and so that's how my experience with God has grown, is like I see how these horrible things that I've gone through have turned into things where it's ended up, I can help somebody, you know? And when I was finally able to sponsor, I was terrified because I thought for sure that, you know, I was going to screw somebody up or make them drink or something. And my sponsor was like, no, you know, you're going to call me if you don't know the answer to something. And every time you meet with them, you're going to say a little prayer before you begin, and God will work through you. You know, and it's not your responsibility to keep them sober. You're just to take them through the steps as you were brought through the steps. And so I started doing that, and I was really active in the program. I had a lot of commitments, and I was answering phones at AA Central, and, you know, back then we did not have Netflix or any of that. We did not have cell phones. Like, we all just kind of stared at each other and, you know, waited for the phone to ring or played cards or something. But, you know, like it was fun, you know, and we'd get like a bunch of young people and we'd all just hang out. And that was fine because I stayed up all night when I was newly sober, and we'd drive to conventions and we'd sleep in the lobby at the convention because we had no money. And, you know, and we'd just have so much fun in sobriety. And I loved everything about recovery. I'd go to the New Year's dance down at the hall in Mission Valley. And you know, I don't know if people still really get into that nowadays, but that was how my first experience with recovery in San Diego was. And when I was 5 years sober, my dad developed brain cancer, and so I went back to New York. And this was the first time I'd spent any kind of significant amount of time with my family since I'd gotten sober. And while I was there, I ended up spending a lot of time with my niece and my two nephews, who were like 6, 5, and 3 at the time. And they really loved hanging out with me, you know. And before, I wouldn't have been able to hang out with them much because they would get in the way of my drinking. You know, like if you wanted to have a sleepover with me on a Saturday night, there's no way that's going to happen. Or if you wanted to see me on a Sunday morning, not going to happen, you know. And anyway, so I fell in love with my niece and my two nephews, and I ended up moving back to New York so that I could, you know, help raise them, basically, because I didn't have any children. I wasn't married. And So I spent the next 10 years there and saw it all the way through until Devin, my niece, got out of high school and went to college. And I moved back here because I never liked the recovery in New York. And for a long time, I didn't go to meetings. I haven't done a lot of things perfectly in this program. And I've spent a long time dry, not going to meetings, not sponsoring people. And the thing is, when I did that, I didn't grow. You know, I was lucky I managed to stay sober during that time. But I'd come back to I came back to San Diego in 2009 and, you know, got right back into commitments and sponsoring people and going to meetings. And I feel like, you know, things have happened for me again, you know, and I did the steps again. And every time I do the steps, a miracle happens, you know. And the last time I did the steps, I was upset because I still hadn't met my soulmate, you know. And I finally decided, you know what, I'm just going to make God my husband. My higher power is going to be my husband. Because, you know, I had to give up. I had to just give it to God, you know. And I had to accept that if I was going to be single, that that's going to be okay. And... And then 6 months later, I met my fiancé, John, who's sitting in the front row here. And we've been together 7 years now. And we have a dog who I love. I'm obsessed with my dog. I didn't get to have children. Motherhood wasn't in my future. But I love my dog like crazy. And I have two kitties, and we have a fish and a snail. It's a regular menagerie over there, but you know, and things aren't always perfect, you know. But I've learned with this program that no matter what is happening, I can call my sponsor, I can talk to my partner, I can talk to the sponsee, I can talk to my friend Miranda, and we can go take weekend trips to Arizona and hang out with rock bands and stuff. It was really fun. I love going to concerts now. I was really afraid of that at first for a long time because I was a Deadhead and I used to follow the Dead, and I was like, I'm never going to be able to go to another Grateful Dead concert. And then Jerry dropped dead in 95 and that was it. So I was like, I'm never going to be able to go to a Dead show. And last July we went and saw Dead and Company, and that was like really cool. I mean, I'd seen like other versions of, you know, Phil Lesh and stuff, but this is like the first time I saw kind of most of them all together. And I go to a lot of concerts now, and that's like part of my spiritual experience too. I love live music, and I love hanging out with my girlfriends. Ditto what Miranda said, go to as many women's meetings as you can, go to men's meetings if you're a man, and get those steps done, you know? Before you decide AA is not for me, do the steps and then say whether or not A is going to be for you or not, you know, because it's not going to work for you if you don't do the steps, if you don't do service, if you don't start passing it on. Because for me, I feel most uplifted in this program when I'm working with another woman and when I'm doing my service, you know, and when I do something that's terrifying, like speak at this meeting. Anyway, I think that's it, right? Am I done? Anyway, thank you guys for letting me talk, and thank you everyone for showing up.